Hello, everyone.
Hey there. Well, I have really been looking forward to this, especially with World Economic Forum wrapping up and increasing calls for stakeholder fascism here in the United States, and also increasing criticism of the agenda by people like Elon Musk and, of course, Peter Thiel. So, Richard, I'm going to let you set the room and tell us why stakeholder capitalism is fascistic.
Well, thank you very much, Jennifer. Your mention of World Economic Forum, because you mentioned it, I might start with that. It is today possibly the biggest proponent of what they call stakeholder capitalism, and its leader, a fellow by the name of Klaus Schwab, has been pushing this for almost 50 years. I think he's in his late 80s or so. It's still active. But as far ago as 1971, when he started the World Economic Forum and wrote books on stakeholder capitalism, he's been pushing this model. But I would say that in the last decade or so, the model has been almost universally embraced, not only by people like Schwab, but by corporate CEOs and business schools and onward. Now, it actually originated in law schools in the late 60s and early 70s. But here's the basic themes I want to suggest, and then I'll talk for about 20 minutes or so, and then open it up for questions. The traditional capitalist model is private ownership and control of the means of production. Now, that's almost socialist-type phrasing, but this is something that the socialists would agree with. It's a definition that they, too, would agree with. I would go beyond the means of production, obviously the products of production, the personal effects that you also own. But their focus has long been on that, and capitalism can be reasonably described, at least from an economic standpoint, and it's also, when you think about it, a legal property rights standpoint, private ownership and control of the means of production. Now, those two aspects are crucial. If you only have title nominally without control, you don't have capitalism. And if you thought of a matrix, I've drawn this many times for my students, I do it in public lectures, but if you just did a simple 2x2 matrix, and on the one, on the horizontal described ownership, and on the vertical described control, and then said private or public, the combination that is both private ownership and private control is capitalism. The complete diagonal opposite is socialism, that's public ownership and public control, public here really meaning the state. But now there are two hybrid systems where they mix the two, and fascism is one of them. The fascist mix is private ownership, but government control. You own the title to your things, but the government tells you what to do with them. And since control, disposition of property is a crucial part of ownership, it is obviously a diluted form of it. But it permits the advocates to say, we're not socialists. See, we're not nationalizing anything. We're not owning anything. We're not seizing anything as the socialists would wish. By the way, the opposite hybrid, not so relevant today, is feudalism. That's ownership, that's government, but private control, the tenant-farmer, tenant-peasants approach model. Now, what's interesting about, and maybe a very dishonest about, the group currently pushing for stakeholder model is that they are not obviously calling it fascism. Other words you hear sometimes in the literature, in universities at least, it's called corporatism. Corporatism is the idea that big business is allowed to own its property, but the government will tell it what to do. So that sounds like fascism, but it's particularly a form that says we need big business precisely because it's easier to control big business. But they're pitching it as a form of capitalism, and this is very insidious, and this is really what I want to stress today, that we should not, as capitalists, permit these various adjectives to be thrown around and be pitched as just a form of capitalism, so don't worry about it. Now, let me just give you a flavor of this so you don't think I'm just asserting this. Schwab himself, here's an excerpt from a 2019 Time magazine essay. What kind of capitalism do we want? That's the title. So you get the pitch here. Quote, what kind of capitalism do we want? I'm quoting from him now. That may be the defining question of our era. If we want to sustain our economic system for future generations, we must answer it correctly. Generally speaking, we have three models to choose from. The first is shareholder capitalism, embraced by most Western corporations, which holds that a corporation's primary goal should be to maximize its profits. The second model is state capitalism, which entrusts the government with setting the direction of the economy and has risen to prominence in many emerging markets, not least China. But compared to these two options, the third has the most to recommend it. Stakeholder capitalism is a model I first proposed a half century ago. It positions private corporations as trustees of society and is clearly the best response to today's social and environmental challenges. Shareholder capitalism, currently the dominant model, first gained ground in the United States in the 1970s and expanded its influence globally in the following decades. Its rise was not without merit, but, and I'm quoting here, now just summarizing now, he goes on to say, it's unsustainable, it's wrecking the planet, it's causing inequality, time to get rid of it. Now, a couple of comments. I would put it this way, shareholder capitalism is a redundancy. That is what capitalism is. And I would say stakeholder capitalism is a contradiction in terms. The use of the word itself is very clever when you think about it, because the original model, and by the way, it does not go back to the 1970s. It goes back as far as the 1800s. I mean, development of capital markets and shares simply mean shares of ownership. When you buy shares in a company, you own it by putting money into the company. So that's what shareholder means. It means you own it. You're the owner. That's not something that's just 50 years old. If anything, the last 50 years have been moving toward the idea that your ownership is not fully under your control. So that's one thing. Now, the other thing he says here, it's the model that says a corporation's primary goal should be to maximize its profits. But actually, its goals are whatever the shareholders want it to be. If the shareholders want it to maximize other things like the share price and things, the point is that's the business of the owners, the shareholders, no one else. Now, what is actually meant by stakeholders? It's a clever phrase because it basically means shareholders plus, now here's the fill in the blank, anyone else who might have an interest in the corporation. Business, other businesses, suppliers, employees, local taxpayers, the government, the planet. The planet is a stakeholder to some in this analysis. And you can see the idea here. It's as if saying, well, we're not like Marx going to talk about seizing the means of production, but put it this way, diluting ownership of the means of production. So simply diluting it and saying, hey, everyone has a stake in this, loosely defined as having some kind of effect on them. If any effect can be found by these entities on others, they have a stake, they have a say in the matter. Now, it's interesting if you try to go into the literature and find out a little more specificity, which I did. I'm flipping here. There's a fascinating essay from a business economist, Samantha Miles. Samantha Miles, in an essay called Stakeholder, Is It Essentially Contested or Just Confused? She went through the literature looking for what stakeholder meant. And she gathered up 435 distinct definitions of stakeholder. Now, what does that tell you? There are lots of, by the way, it's coincidentally the number of seats in the House of Representatives, but you get the point. The issue is anyone and anybody for any reason allegedly has a say in how corporations are run. Now, Milton Friedman, for all his inconsistencies in defending free markets, wrote a very famous New York Times Magazine essay in 1970, questioning the whole social responsibility of business paradigm and stressing that businesses should do the shareholder model and stick to it. So he was noticing even then in 1970, long time ago, that they were moving away from that and basically sacrificing where necessary shareholder interests. I think one of the more interesting developments in the last decade is that whereas there might be CEO suite resistance to this 50 years ago, even 40 years ago, definitely during the Reagan years, there's almost no resistance to it, whatever. And for those who are, you know, scratching their heads as to how that can be, it's just not true that because you're a capitalist financially, just because you're a CEO, just because you're in quote business, that you're going to be pro-capitalist ideologically. And these people, especially the ones who get into corporate suites, are usually going to prestigious business schools. They're usually going to Ivy Leagues. And so they're going to get the same kind of bad philosophy, the same kind of altruism and collectivism that's taught in the humanities and in the social sciences. That definitely creeps into business. And that's what's been happening over the last decades. The business schools following the law schools, all the professions are going to be affected by philosophy departments and social science departments, have adopted this model. And I would say the other aspect of this is it's very difficult if you rise to a position of prominence in a major multinational corporation, you are going to come in contact with the government far more than if you were a small business. So this phenomenon people see of smaller businesses, entrepreneurs who tend to lean more pro-capitalist than the corporates, that's one of the reasons. The first reason is they're trained in the same universities that produce altruist collectivists. But then secondly, they cannot escape the revolving door, so to speak, between government controls and their businesses, the bigger the businesses they are. Now, it's one of the features of Italian and Nazi fascism that they preferred big business to small business. And I hinted at this before. Why? Because it's easier to control big business. If you had one or two steel makers, one or two munitions makers, you know, a handful only of power makers, things like that, it's easier to institute your controls. And so, but this is another reason why people are sometimes fooled into thinking, well, this is a form of capitalism, because they don't seem to be anti-business. They seem to be pro-big business. And since big business over the decades has really been demonized, the big bad business, it seems like, well, here's a model that doesn't seem to demonize them. So what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is it's fascism. It's a fascistic form of political economy, and it's very dangerous. Now, by the way, when you look at historical cases of fascism, Mussolini's, the Hitler's, the drama and the histrionics are so over the top that that's another reason why people might not see what's coming this time, because it doesn't have the kind of look and feel of what those crazy regimes had and what they did. And so this is a control, almost like a self-inflicted thing, where it may not look authoritarian, but it definitely is. It's just a different form of it. The president, Biden, interesting quote when he was running in 2020, this captures it, and all his team is this way too, quote, "It's way past time we put an end to the era of shareholder capitalism. The idea that the only responsibility a corporation has is with shareholders. That's simply not true. It's an absolute farce. They have a responsibility to their workers, their community, their country. That's not new. That's not a new or radical notion," unquote. Now, unfortunately, yes, it's not a new notion. It's radical, but it's not new because it's borrowed from the 1930s. We are literally seeing in Davos and WEF and elsewhere a group of people, a group of very prominent leaders in business, academia, and government advocating this system. And so it's a revival of the 30s model of fascism. I want to point out something that I found in the literature, which is very odd and paradoxical, but revealing at the same time. In the early 1930s, there was a very famous and influential book called The Modern Corporation and Private Property. And it was written by a lawyer and an economist, I think they were both from Columbia, Burl and Means. Now, Burl and Means, interestingly, were saying that capitalism was not sustainable because companies were getting so big that there was a separation of ownership and control. So in other words, they would say something like, well, you might have at one point had Henry Ford start Ford Motor Company, and he was both the owner and the operator of the enterprise, right? But the bigger these companies get, like they become General Electric or General Motors or General Food, the very bigness of these companies, the very fact that they were mass market companies meant that the ownership had to be more diversified. And that's why companies went to stock exchanges and issued shares to the general public to raise money broadly, because, you know, individuals themselves, sole proprietorships, couldn't raise the capital necessary to keep these companies operating. Now, the interesting solution they ignored was that legally and otherwise there were methods of making sure that the managers, although now not the major shareholders, would still be motivated to work on behalf of the owners. So either through compensation plans, maybe even stock ownership plans, the idea was to, as best possible, wed the two, have this fiduciary relationship where the principal agent relationship worked. The owners were not exploiting the shareholders. At any rate, what's interesting about that critique, it was an anti-capitalist critique. It was a critique by Berle and Means saying basically capitalism could not make this transition to big business without losing this tie. Well, if you think about what's going on today, the advocacy is to break the tie. That the old complaint was that managers aren't working for shareholders. And now the complaint is managers are working for shareholders. So they have completely flipped the script. It's still a critique of the corporation, but it's of an entirely different, well, I wouldn't say entirely different. It's a different form of fascism. But notice now, they want to break ownership and control. They do not want the managers, the CEOs and others, to be working only for the owners. And so they're advocating precisely the kind of separation and ownership and control that used to be acclaimed as a great weakness of capitalism. A couple of other things, then I'll quit. Here's another quote, just to give you a flavor, from Schwab himself, Klaus Schwab, from his book, Stakeholder Capitalism, subtitled A Global Economy That Works for Progress, People, and the Planet. January 2021, quote, the sudden and all-encompassing impact of COVID-19 made us understand much more than the gradual effects of climate change or increasing inequality that an economic system driven by selfish and short-term interests is not sustainable. It is unbalanced, fragile, and increases the chance of societal, environmental, and public health disasters. We can't continue with an economic system driven by selfish values, such as short-term profit maximization, the avoidance of tax burdens and regulation, or the externalizing of environmental harm. Instead, we need a society, an economy, and an international community designed to care for all people and the entire planet. From a system of shareholder capitalism, which prevailed in the West in the past 50 years, and a system of state capitalism that gained prominence in Asia, we should be moving toward a system of stakeholder capitalism, unquote. Now, and notice, by the way, the state capitalism concept, just amazing. So China, under this model, under this interpretation, China is a form of capitalism. They call it state capitalism. So the terminology, the abuse of concepts and what concepts really mean are just despicable in my view, but it's a way to blur the distinctions precisely so that a system of pure private property capitalism isn't allowed. It's really not allowed in the debate, so to speak. So couching it this way is very clever, but no one should fall for this. There really needs to be a pushback. Don't, just as we should not allow the term crony capitalism to survive, we shouldn't be allowing stakeholder capitalism. These are perversions of capitalism, and they're trying to justify them by using this kind of terminology. I think I'll stop there. There's more to say, and maybe there's some questions that will bring out other things I would like to say. But if you're worried for those looking for actual legislation in the United States that might be pertinent to this, Elizabeth Warren, the biggest advocate of stakeholder capitalism, has proposed legislation called accountable capitalism. Very revealing. So the idea, the Accountable Capitalism Act 2019, is just filled with the stakeholder language, and it's the idea that current capitalism is not accountable. You know, that the shareholders, presumably the shareholders, cannot make the managers accountable, and yet that is not the goal of stakeholder capitalism. They want the managers and executives accountable to politicians and pressure groups and a whole bunch of other groups. So I'll stop there and take questions or comments.
Thanks, Richard. I see a lot of newcomers in the room, which is encouraging. I'd love to get a few more new people introduced to the topic. So please share the conversation. Use that share button at the bottom. Share it on Clubhouse. Ping some friends into the room. I want to break 30. Keep it above there. So, David, did you have some thoughts that you wanted to add?
Well, first of all, thank you, Richard, for as an epistemologist, I really appreciate your analysis, putting this in terms of, you know, invalid concepts and floating concepts and package deals. That's, you know, absolutely right. And it's almost a distinctively objectivist approach to analyzing these questions. So thanks for that. My question has to do with John Mackey, Whole Foods, and so-called conscious capitalism. Mackey's very prominent in the libertarian movement, and in many ways, seems like a friend of our approach, and yet when he describes conscious capitalism, it sounds a lot like stakeholder stuff. In fact, I don't know if he uses the term, but do you have thoughts on that and comment about the conscious capitalist movement or initiative?
Yes, David, I'm familiar with Mackey's approach. The terminology itself suggests what the complaint is about, you know. So conscious capitalism, sometimes you hear compassionate capitalism. The implication is, as Klaus Schwab put it, this is a selfish system. It's therefore lacking in compassion, lacking in morality, lacking in, well, long term, all the caricatures of what a self-interested person or company would be, heartless, callous, cruel, you know, willing to lay off workers, willing to destroy the planet, that kind of thing. So the good news is people like Mackey glimpse that capitalism is a good system, and they see it under attack. And they're defensive. I would put them down as the timid, defensive friends of capitalism. But they're just being rolled by the critics of capitalism. So I think what we're missing is a full-throated, you know, unapologetic defense of capitalism. And that's why you're getting all these adjectives. I have a chapter in my latest book on what's called varieties of capitalism that actually comes from the academic literature. So the whole idea of varieties with all these adjectives, social capitalism, Christian capitalism, I've heard all of them, crony capitalism. But it is interesting that it's almost as if, and this comes from the Marxist literature, capitalism is one in a way. It has, oddly enough, they'll say simultaneously, it has survived as the lone standing system after the disasters of the last century, and yet they still hate it. They still don't like it. And so they're trying to modify it and change it and adulterate it and dilute it. And, you know, it's something like that, David. And And then now they're just quibbling over ways to erode it, is the way I would put it. But that method of John, Mackey's usually comes from CEOs who are, you know, if you scratch deep, there's some we're regretting that we're losing this system. But what kind of defensive mode can I take in the meantime?
Well, I know that those of us who have engaged with Mackey, including our chairman of the board, Jay LaPere,
yeah,
point out that, you know, anyone running a business to be successful has to provide a value, some value to his customers. He's got to have the best employees he can get, which means treating them fairly, train them, et cetera. So, I mean, but all for the benefit of making the business the most effective value creator. And this doesn't seem to make any dent in the shareholder or the conscious capitalist people.
Right. And another attitude of this is, I remember John saying one time in a debate with an objectivist, well, would you say that every entrepreneur in Atlas Shrugged is a profit maximizer? Do they have any other motive? And so suppose the answer to that was yes, they have many motives. The point is, this model is trying to throw off private ownership. And yeah. And any privately owned company can adopt any goal it wishes. That's not the issue. So it's the critics of capitalism. It's the critics of this model that are trying to shoehorn the goal. You know, what are you maximizing profit? Now, even that profit is considered theft. Profit is considered, if it's excessive, the profit itself is distrusted. So anything he's saying, well, the purpose of the company is to maximize profits. I mean, to their ear, that sounds like the purpose of a company is to maximize evil things. And of course, they would want to move away from that to a more balanced, quote unquote, balanced approach. So I don't know if that helps or not. But by the way, I wanted to add that you may, as you learn about this or discuss it, be aware that you'll be accused of conspiracy theory. So this is especially the case with the World Economic Forum and Davos. And I mean, that is an agglomeration of people that are in constant contact and meet, at the Swiss Alps once a year and stuff. And if you go to their website, they're unabashed about saying they want this system. Sometimes they call it the Great Reset. But just be aware, it's not necessary to say, and it's not true, that there's some small, Illuminati cabal gathering in the Swiss Alps, trying to impose one world government on us. That's not what's happening. The only reason it seems like a conspiracy is that there's almost universal agreement on this fallacy. And when you see people universally agreeing on some fallacy, including populists, by the way, including people who hate the elites, people who might be populist supporters of Trump say they might be anti-WEF, they might be anti-Davos, but that it's because they're also suspicious of big corporations. So the big corporation with the shareholder model is really under attack from almost, or under suspicion from almost every side. Other than, I would say, our side. I know of no other side other than objectivism that has any sense of what the corporate model is and why it's an important part of the private property system.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah. Clark, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you, Jay. And thank you, Richard. And actually,
you're welcome.
Richard, I think, yes, you were actually beginning to answer my question, and it seems as if I've read you correctly or listened to you correctly, that the only group that maybe has some pushback to this this stakeholder idea is on the populist right, the people who, like you're saying, they hate Facebook, they hate Google, You know, they want to impinge on the First Amendment. They hate Big Pharma. They consider that all maybe not a conspiracy, but just somehow they're not looking out for the middle American. So, and again, you know, it seems as if from what you know, I've read from some of these folks, you know, their solution, of course, is more government regulation of, you know, of the big globalists and the, you know, and of course Trump would want to you know, use tariffs and all, just anything to get at the big, you know, transnational corporations. So of course I guess that's worse than that's a worse cure than what the disease is. I mean, how do we appeal to these folks if we can? I mean, what should our approach be? Because it looks kind of glum, as you're saying, glum. That there's just doesn't look like there's many people anywhere on the modern political spectrum in the U.S. or in the West who agree with us, subjectivists.
Well, I would say the first, possibly most important thing is to stress the morality of profit and profit seeking. Now, if you go from that to mom and pop store, to small business, to big business, to multinationals, it's almost invariably true that people will say, well, I get it, how my business or my local grocer provides value and makes money. But the bigger the company gets, people seem to think now some kind of fraud or nefarious activity is involved. And that's, if you can somehow say to them, listen, just because you're getting bigger doesn't mean your profit motive or your profits are becoming adulterated. You're just meeting more customers. You have more customers than the small guy has. And so, I mean, that's just a very small thing. But starting with the idea that defend profit as to that it's economically value added. It's not a zero-sum game. It's not stolen. It's value created. That alone is a big thing to get across to people. But then also that it's moral, that it's the commercial manifestation of rational self-interest. That's what the profit motive is. It's the business application of rational egoism. So if they're going to distrust rational egoism, of course they're going to distrust the profit motive. But the key is also to really emphasize that bigness is not badness. Now, that's a negative way of putting it, but put it as bigness is a sign of massive, mass market success. And if anything, companies should be extolled for doing that. So that's, I hope that helps. But yeah, if you line up the people who are anti-corporate, it's obviously Marxists, right? But some conservatives who believe in the antitrust laws, for example, that the antitrust laws were advocated by Republicans, the Sherman Act. Sherman was an Ohio Republican, 1890. But the Chicago School for many years advocated, Milton Friedman and Stigler and others advocated antitrust on the grounds that capitalism left to its own devices would lead to concentrations of capital and monopoly and blah, 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 blah. So they have long also contributed to a suspicion of bigness. And then the biggest movement, I would say, of the last decade is populism. And populism is anti-capitalism. People think it's maybe pro-capitalist because sometimes they bring in right-wing leaders. But the populist approach, I know we're not here to talk about populism, but it does contribute to this stakeholder approach, is highly suspicious of anything big, highly suspicious of anything establishment, highly suspicious of anything elite, any group educated with credentials and that kind of thing. And that's what successful long-term businesses have. And so if there's going to be a suspicion against all those great virtues, it's going to come to redound to the harm of big corporations as well. So the populists themselves will listen to this kind of thing. And on the one hand, they'll say, who are those elites in Davos? You know, what do they know? Why are they telling us what to do? On the other hand, if they hear, well, they're trying to control corporations. Their model is to tell corporations what to do. Now the populist isn't so upset anymore. Now the populist thinks, oh, that ain't so bad. I want that too.
Thanks, Richard. Jerry.
Yeah, I just thought it would be useful to remind us of how Ayn Rand would classify exactly this type of invalid concept, right? I'm sure most of us know that she would classify it as anti-concept, something that is rationally unusable, and now it comes specifically meant to obliterate the original rational concept, in this case, shareholder. So just from the epistemological perspective, I think it's good to know this. And whenever we encounter this concept, it's not just, you know, you're against capitalism if you use this concept. You know, it's good to really use this term. You know, you are using something that is not a concept. This is anti-concept. You're destroying our ability to form and use concept. So it's, I think, very useful to classify it in this way and to use this term anti-concept, which stakeholder capitalism or stakeholder exactly is. Thanks.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. And another approach would be to say to people, why are you using the term stakeholder when we have this term shareholder, and you yourself are contrasting the two? Isn't a stakeholder a non-owner? They would have to say yes. They would have to say legally, yes, that is not an owner. Then the next question you ask them is, why should a non-owner have any say in the property rights of other people? Now, they might say, well, corporations and responsibility and third-party externalities. And another approach to this would be to say, imagine if someone said, you own your body and mind, technically, but I'm going to tell you what to do with it. I'm going to tell you whether to have an abortion or not. I'm going to tell you whether to take a vaccine jab or not. I'm going to tell you whether to work in the cotton fields for me or not. I'm going to tell you whether there can be same-sex marriage or not. Now, most people on all those examples would recoil in horror. My body, my choice, right? They would say, well, okay, my business, my choice. Very good model. My business, my choice. What right do you have as a quote-unquote stakeholder, which is not a shareholder? You do not own me. You do not own my business. You have no say in the matter. That it is that kind of, I think, moral certitude and pushback that can help here. By the way, on terminology, sometimes you'll hear about ESG, and ESG is a big part of this stakeholder stuff. ESG stands for environment, social, and governance criteria, and the stakeholder collectivists have very cleverly come up with a set of metrics to measure companies and how woke they are, how much they're attending to stakeholder interests. And this is very important because not only is it very vicious, it's going to become important because government policy is leveraging off of this. So agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission is working on policies to mandate that companies report their ESG compliance, if you will. To what extent are they complying with serving the environment? To what extent are they complying with serving social issues, not shareholder issues, things like that. So this is how you codify and institutionalize in law these bad theories. You start using metrics, and nobody questions the basic theory. So they're not going to, you know, object to the metrics. The metrics are just a way of empirically carrying out the theory. Well, if you really believe this stuff, then you'll adopt these measures. And then the SEC and these other agencies can come in and see if you're following these measures or not. And maybe it'll determine whether we, you know, permit mergers and acquisitions or permit you to have business freedom or not. The other approach, which is very clever and insidious, is... the stakeholder activists have already, I mean, this has been going on for years, the top CPA firms, the top accounting firms, and pushing and pressuring them to adopt these ESG standards as well, and in terms of doing the audit of the corporation. So the CPA firms now are all universally on board with this approach, and they themselves are pressuring companies to report their performance along these lines. A third source of pressure comes from investment firms. So the biggest investment firms in the country today are probably Blackstone, State Street, Vanguard. These are in themselves successful companies who have accumulated people's savings and invested them in the stock market and the bond market and other things. But because of that, they have enormous leverage over corporate governance. They themselves hold the shares on your behalf. You almost never vote for major corporate issues, but they do. That model should be broken probably and amended, but that's happening as well. So the leaders, Larry Fink is a famous leader at Blackstone. I think it's BlackRock. I'm sorry, not Blackstone. BlackRock Financial. And so same kind of thing. You get a CEO of a major investment firm that believes this stuff. It's going to trickle down and affect all the CEOs whose companies he invests in. So it's coming, this pressure to do this is coming from every angle, government, business, legal, otherwise.
Thanks. And I just also pinned the link to Morals and Markets. It's a seminar that Professor Salzman conducts monthly on behalf of the Atlas Society. It is for young people, so please share it with the students in your life. And if you'd like to audit it, you're welcome. Just we ask that you do so without with your camera off. Matt.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask. I've read Richard Reich's book on, he called it super capitalism. I didn't think it was either, but I was hoping just to get comment on that if you've read it.
Yes, I think you mean Robert Reich from Berkeley. Yeah, I mean, he's been a longtime advocate of this approach. He was at Harvard for many years, and now he's at Berkeley. I think he was a labor secretary under Clinton. Yeah, but it's the same thing. It's using the word capitalism to push something that's really anti-capitalist. And, you know, for him, super capitalism is a capitalism run by government, where corporations are told what to do by government. So Reich just follows in this. I mean, he has various minor variations on the theme, but he was a big advocate during the 80s of what was called industrial policy. So that was much more government central planning and early versions of Reich, he actually wanted government to nationalize certain things. So he straddles both fences. He's part nationalized things, that's socialism, but he's also basically of the fascistic version of telling businesses what to do.
All right, we're coming up on about 15 minutes left. So let's definitely want to try to get to everybody up on stage. So we'll try to keep these quick. Lawrence.
Hi, Richard. Great topic. My question was, looking at history, I kind of see similarities in sort of this idea of control of some larger entity trying to instill sort of economic order, and sort of similarities for what I kind of see them talking about at Davos and whatnot is, I wanted to see if you would agree, disagree, your thoughts on the relationship to the, I believe it was the European Economic Community was what it was called, that was like in the 80s or 90s, which acted as a sort of economic supranational entity trying to organize how markets operated in Europe. I just wanted to see if perhaps this is something we're seeing now just on a global scale.
Well, I wouldn't say no. I would not say it's the same thing. Those efforts, the European Community, the European Economic Union, were attempts to lower trade barriers and labor law barriers and harmonize tax systems and things like that. Even the development of the euro, the currency, replacing 10 or 12 other currencies at the end of 99 was an attempt to, what I interpreted as a move toward more capitalism. So that's not what's going on here. Here you have global entities, the World Bank, the UN, and others trying to dictate to companies what to do, and somewhat on the pretext, well, since they're cross-border, since they're multinational, we need huge you know, NGOs and government entities to control them. But no, that earlier attempt in the 70s, really post-World War II, to free up Europe was a good trend, but it pretty much ended 20 years ago. The trend is now toward, okay, you're welcome. Before I forget, I wanted to, just on a positive note, for those who want to study this further, there are really two very good defenses of the corporation, the most famous by an objectivist named Robert Hessen, H-E-S-S-E-N. In 1979, at the Hoover Institution, he wrote a book called In Defense of the Corporation. Really a fabulous book, and not easy to find, but In Defense of the Corporation by Hessen, H-E-S-S-E-N. And more recently, in 2013, there is a book I found that does critique the stakeholder model by a guy named Samuel Mansell, M-A-N-S-E-L-L. It's called Capitalism, Corporations, and the Social Contract, A Critique of Stakeholder Theory. I've read the book, and it has some weaknesses in it, but it's a rare case of someone standing up and saying the stakeholder model is bad. Don't go there.
All right, we'll try to find those and drop them in the chat. Sam.
Hi. Thank you, Jennifer, Richard. Anne Rand, she talked about four main pillars of her philosophy: objective reality, absolute reason, and then the two I wanted to focus on, individualism and laissez-faire capitalism. She went on to say that the only action which a government can take to protect free capitalism is laissez-faire. But as we all know, in laissez-faire, monopolies can occur. And yes, if she's advocating individualism, by all means, an entrepreneur as individualism would love to have a monopoly. But for society's benefit, as we know, it stifles competition, innovation, and is not for the greater good of society. So is she in favor of monopolies? Is she implying that monopolies are okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. Good question. Yes, in this view, monopolies are perfectly fine. If by mono we mean one supplier of some good, yes, as long as they don't coerce anybody, as long as they don't mandate that anybody buy the product, as long as they didn't get that position by any government favors, franchises, monopolies. Government itself issues monopoly licenses and things like that, as you know. And so the most famous case, probably Alcoa, which at one point I think had 95% of the aluminum market, and was exploiting no one and was bringing price down and stuff. So some of the great capitalist quote-unquote monopolies were producing in great abundance and bringing prices down and were still profitable. So economies of scale and all that. So what she and pro-capitalists should definitely be against is government monopolies granted by government. And the most famous ones, of course, are schools. I mean, the public schools today, the Federal Reserve is a monopoly of money. There's a lot of monopolies, very abusive, long-term abusive, deleterious monopolies that the government still maintains that they that should be gotten rid of. It might interest you, Sam. I think sometimes individualism, which I think is a key pillar of capitalism, sometimes people think of that as atomistic, that people not joining together in groups and stuff. But if you think about it, the corporation itself is a collective, but in the good sense of a group that gets together for a particular mission, you know, to produce a product and make money. And so individualism is not at all incompatible with collective action, if you want to call it that. The key is the individual under capitalism is not subordinated to the group. They choose to participate in a group. They can leave a group if they don't want to work with that group anymore. But I bring this up only because one of the most important groups we have out there are businesses. And if these entities are going to be taken over by fascists, that's something we really have to worry about and trouble ourselves with. So laissez-faire, I'm going to do a separate future clubhouse on laissez-faire, because I actually have a different take on laissez-faire than Rand and most of the objectivists. If laissez-faire literally means no connection between government and the economy, I think that's platonic and impossible. I don't think that's actually the objectivist position or Ayn Rand's position, but it can be interpreted and misinterpreted it that way. And I think it's a hurdle to getting people to embrace capitalism, because as I said before, if you use all these adjectives like state capitalism or crony capitalism or stakeholder capitalism, which to me are all invalid concepts, is that they'll say, so what kind of capitalism do you want? And objectivists are prone to saying, just to distinguish themselves, they're prone to saying laissez-faire capitalism. But laissez-faire means hands off, don't touch, literally, various interpretations of it. And that's not really what we have here. We have an objectivist argument that says the government should provide mechanisms to protect individual rights, but that includes police, courts, military, and the funding necessary for that. I contend that it's impossible to have those things without touching the economy. So, but I'll leave that to a later time.
Yeah, let's we can discuss get that three speakers here. Bill, you look like you're unmuted, but you may be having a frequent issue that we sometimes get on this platform where you don't have full connection. So if you can't unmute, try signing out, signing back in. Otherwise, we'll go to Eric. Welcome to Clubhouse and welcome to the room.
Thank you, Jennifer. Richard, I liked your kind of, your plane of ownership versus control. How you kind of categorize those things helped me kind of visualize shareholders versus stakeholders. I was wondering what your thought is on the kind of Elon Musk Twitter thing. Where would Elon Musk and Twitter fall on this plane of control versus ownership before the purchase and after the purchase? Thanks.
That's a good question. I mean, it's still a private company. I mean, it's publicly traded, but Twitter's a privately owned company. The stakeholder model would say something like, well, if Elon Musk buys it, he can't just serve Elon Musk. He can't just serve the shareholder. He has to serve a broader audience. What broader audience? Well, fill in the blank. That Ministry of Truth agency that they tried to create a couple of weeks ago, they'd have a say in the matter. I will tell you what to put on Twitter or not. It fits my model so far as this is still a semi-capitalist country, and that Musk owning Twitter would be the sole shareholder. There wouldn't be a diversified shareholder base in that regard. So basically thinking of taking it private. So it's a unique circumstance. But the question for me would be whether Elon really runs it. First of all, if they allow him to own it. I don't know if the government will allow him to go through with this owner, purchase offer. I doubt that myself. Or if they do, whether they'll run him into the ground on Tesla, SpaceX, and other things. They really do not want, the government really does not want him to take over Twitter. So it's going to be a test of this model. But let's just be clear that the stakeholder model does not like the idea of this guy owning this entity and being the sole determinant of what its policy should be.
Bill.
Thank you.
Hi, Richard. This is Bill. Can you please talk about a little bit about the Business Roundtable and their 2019 statement? My basic question is, why would so many CEOs be so fond of stakeholder capitalism?
Yeah, good question, Bill. For those who don't know, the Business Roundtable in 2019 issued a statement saying we are no longer supporting the shareholder model, and they basically endorsed the stakeholder model. Now, the reason that was important is that the Business Roundtable for many, many decades, it's been around for a long time, was basically a special interest group for big companies, CEOs of huge companies. So I think all I could say really, Bill, is they finally caved in, and as to the supposed mystery of why big business executives would go this way, I go back to my earlier point that they have received the same kind of education, or call it miseducation, as everyone else in the universities, because they're usually MBAs, they're usually coming out of the Ivy League schools, and I know this isn't hard to believe for the general public, but those business schools for decades have been teaching critiques of the shareholder model and have been endorsing more and more the stakeholder model. And I think, and so they're just prepped for that to be that way. Now the outside pressures that come from things like, you know, woke waves, like we've seen in the last 3 to 5 years, or COVID things, or the financial crisis. I mean, if you think of what's happened in the last 20 years, you got 9/11, you have the financial crisis of 08, you got COVID. So crises are moments when the statists love to grab power and make the recalcitrants quiver and be fearful. So I took the Business Roundtable decision in 2019 as a kind of cowardly act and an appeasement by these big executives. But it's not like there were holdouts who believed in capitalism in the way we did. By the time 2019 rolled around, the Business Roundtable folks were brainwashed with the same kind of fallacy.
It's interesting, as part of their statement, they had the following sentence: "We believe the free market system is the best means of generating good jobs."
Yeah.
In other words, they're at the same time they're claiming that they believe in the free market system. They also, anyway. Thank you, right. Richard.
It's a good point.
We've just had a few more minutes. I'd like to turn to my creative partner, Patrick. Also, want to give a shout out to some of the other members of our faculty, Professor Jason Hill and Professor Stephen Hicks in the room. Appreciate your guys joining. Patrick.
Hey, thanks, Richard. Great talk. Education for me. I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about the motivations, particularly behind us having this, you know, like a stakeholder system from the populist side. From my standpoint, I think it's, you know, whenever you engage in a full-throated defense of capitalism, it's almost as though we're talking about two different things. Because the stakeholder people tend to be concerned about things like fraud, and although maybe they call it something else. I'm not talking about those who are concerned about, you know, like wokeness, but let's say, you know, fraud or getting or special relationships with the government, which enable them to grow or have this success. So then there's sort of a suspicion, because so many of them are ensconced with the government that helped them get to that size. Is there kind of a place to, you know, to sort of emphasize that like that's the problem, you know, that is the problem, not some, and the corporations can't really do anything about that. They could not take the money or what, but then they're going to. That make sense?
It does, Patrick, and I think you're onto something there. The way I would interpret what's going on is these are fascism, particularly the stakeholder model, is a hybrid political economic system. Where did it come from? A hybrid ethic. People don't totally believe in egoism; they also believe in altruism. And a hybrid, you know, they're not total individualists, they're also collectivists. So it, from an objectivist standpoint, just philosophically, the hierarchical structure, it's not a mystery why you would get a mixed political economic system, because it came from a mixed ethical, you know, and deeper system. Same thing on faith and reason, that mixes in people's minds. But I think you're right. Once you get the mixed economy, people cannot easily disentangle whether a big company made it, quote, on its own or not. I think that's a big problem, Patrick. I think you're absolutely right. And they see corruption, and they see lobbying, and they see, you know, favoritism and the turnstile of back and forth between Wall Street. They see bailouts and all this. They see campaign finance. And so it's really disheartening, because you now have to say to people, well, it's a mixed system, but what's really hurting us is the mixture that's poisonous called statism. And the good element, capitalism, is not to be blamed. And it's very difficult to get across to people, because there are others out there wanting to blur the distinctions. That's what the whole terminology is: stakeholder, crony capitalism. You don't have people out there like us trying to disentangle the good and bad elements and get conceptual clarity. So that makes it harder for populists. I sympathize with populists who say, I'm sick of the whole bunch of them. If this is what our elites have brought us, you know, so much for elites. But if you go the other route of, you know, just popular resentment, popular uprising, the common man, there's a kind of an ignorance level there that's, you know, hard to believe that that would get us out of this. What we need is better elites. We need better intellectuals. We need better business leaders. We need more pro-capitalist leaders, in effect. So I tend to resist populism and defend, as Jason Hill has recently, meritocracy, elitism, but from the standpoint of we need the best and the brightest, and that's what capitalism gives us. We need the best and the brightest, the best virtuously, the brightest epistemologically, and then we'll be safe and happier.
Thanks,
Patrick.
This was an amazing room, amazing discussion. Thank you so much, Professor Salzman. Thanks also to our founder, David Kelly, to my co-host, Scott, and I mentioned Patrick Riesenover. If you'd like to check out some of the videos that we've produced together, please go to the Atlas Society website. Under the Now Playing section, you'll see our vast library of Draw My Life videos now being translated into dozens of foreign languages. So thank you, everyone. I've put a pin to where you can sign up to get updates because we keep the content coming fast and furious. Next week, we've got a couple of clubhouses. Rob Trusinski, Is Religion Necessary for Free Society? And then, as well, we have another one with Jason Hill, Ayn Rand and Civil Disobedience. I'm also going to be interviewing a live webinar next week with Rachel Ferguson on her book, Black Liberation Through the Marketplace. So thanks, everybody, and look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you all. Thank you very much.